Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to this presentation tonight. It's a little different venue than I'm used to, because I'm used to having the battlefield right behind me. But I'm going to try to create it in your imagination this evening. 3 days after this battle, George Armstrong Custer is found on the top of Last Stand Hill. He's stripped to his socks. He's got a gunshot wound to the head, a gunshot wound to the chest. His thigh has been slashed to the bone, fingertip cut off, ears punctured by sewing awls by the Cheyenne women, and an arrow shoved into his private parts. His brother, Captain Tom Custer, 2 Medal of Honor recipient in the Civil War, disemboweled, head smashed to the thickness of a pancake, shot full of arrows. You can't recognize Tom Custer except for a tattoo on his left arm. TWC, Thomas Ward Custer. Ladies and gentlemen, these were angry times. 263 soldiers will die. 210 of Custer's men, all 5 companies of his battalion, destroyed. 60 warriors dead, maybe more. We'll never know. They were not buried on the battlefield. They were hauled away and buried in trees and caves and scaffolding. But soldiers buried on the battlefield where they fell. It's the only battlefield in the world where white tombstones indicate where soldiers died and were buried where they fell, in shallow graves. Custer got the deepest grave, 18 inches. He was thrown into that pit with his brother Tom. Rocks and a basket were put over the top of it, and the army departed the area. 1 year later, the army came out again. It was a scene of sickening, ghastly horror. Men retching and vomiting. Skeletal remains all over the battlefield because wolves and coyotes and predators had jerked the bodies out, devoured the flesh. When it comes time to disinter Custer and take him back to West Point and bury him along with other officers buried in the east, the basket's gone, the rocks are removed. There's not enough material left of George Armstrong Custer to put into a hat. The commanding officer, Lieutenant Colonel Michael Sheridan, says, "Nail the box shut." It doesn't matter, because the public will believe anything. That box is taken back to West Point in October of 1877. It's buried in the ground. 57, can you turn off that light, that projector light? It's kind of killing me. 57 years later, in 1933, at the age of 91, Elizabeth Custer, wife of George Armstrong Custer, dies. She's buried next to the box. That may be George Armstrong Custer, what was left to him, and it may be Private Murphy. We'll never know, ever. It became quickly known as Custer's last stand. But in reality, it was a lot more than his last stand. It was really the last stand of a way of life. Because for the Sioux and the Cheyenne, a year later, you're either in Canada with Sitting Bull, on a reservation, or you're dead. 3,000 books written on the battle, more than Gettysburg. 35 movies made, 34 of them junk. It's the most mythologized piece of military history we own. And I look around, it's hard to see because that light is blinding me. As I look around, I don't see any children in here. So I'm going to make a bet. There's not a person in this audience who's never heard of George Armstrong Custer or Crazy Horse or Sitting Bull. They're legends. How did this happen? And why did it happen? Well, honestly, folks, it's a culminating event because it marks nearly 400 years of cultural animosity, cultural friction, and cultural disdain between Euro-Americans and Native Americans, and the fight was always over the same thing. The land, who would occupy it, how it would be used, and who would be allowed to traverse across it. Because you see, when Euro-Americans come out west, they see huge expanses of territory. And they see grass and water and timber and minerals in the ground, particularly that yellow metal that makes the white man go crazy. And when they see all these resources, they envision farms and towns and ranches and railroads and telegraphs and barbed wire fences. All of it driven by a new religion called manifest. Manifest destiny, the belief that somehow Euro-Americans are sanctioned. They're ordained by God to spread across the continent. Conquer it, subdue it, and tame it. From coast to coast, sea to shining sea, there's just one problem with that vision. There's people already here. And they have their own vision of what life's going to be like. And I'm going to argue this, that they're the freest people on earth. Because when they get horses from the Spanish in the early 1700s, they can go from Mexico to Canada in pursuit of huge herds of the 2,000-pound super-walking Walmart store of the plains. Food, shelter, clothing, weapons, utensils, fuel, medicines, and about 50 other uses, the buffalo. And by the way, folks, in 1840, estimates 60 million buffalo on the plains. And by 1890, 50 years later, there's less than 500 left on the planet. When Euro-Americans come out west, they want to turn the Sioux and the Cheyenne and the Arapaho and the Blackfoot and the Crow, they want to turn them all into Christian farmers. Well, Sitting Bull's not about to bend over and scratch and claw at the ground with a hoe to try to make a living. And Crazy Horse is not going to surrender his pony and hook it up to a plow. They're hunters and they're warriors. And that's their vision. You know, folks, in the 1870s, I think you all took U.S. history probably sometime in your high school years. I hope you had a good teacher. I'm a retired teacher. I had a lousy history teacher. I got a D. Lester Patterson was 129 years old. All he ever did was lecture and give us a test on the dates. Remember those days, folks? They don't teach like that anymore. But in any event, if you had a good teacher, you might have learned that the economy in 1873 went south. The panic of 1873, the stock market crashes, the banking system fails. People are unable to pay their bills. There's no work, 20% unemployment. Some of them are jumping out of windows. It's a dark time in America. At the helm, President Ulysses S. Grant, war hero, honest man, but he surrounded himself with crooks. That never happens today, does it? Grant's up against a wall because he's got an anemic economy and he's looking real hard for an economic stimulus package. George Custer's going to give it to him. Because Lieutenant Colonel George Custer is going to march into the Black Hills, western South Dakota. He's going to come out of Fort Abraham Lincoln, Bismarck, Dakota Territory, with 1,000 soldiers, march into western South Dakota, official mission to find potential fort sites. But in reality, it's a gold expedition. Rumors of gold had persisted for years in the Black Hills. Custer goes into the Black Hills. He takes along mining engineers, geologists who know how to find traces of gold and where it can be found. He also brings along newspaper reporters, because he loves the press, and the press love him. And you know and I know the press always tells the truth. They get to the Black Hills, reports get out. All you got to do is get to the Black Hills, walk through the grass, pick up nuggets off the tops of your shoes, and go home rich. Fake news. But they believe it. They pour into the Black Hills, miners and prospectors. Deadwood explodes. Only problem is, every single one of them is an illegal alien. You can't be in the Black Hills if you're white, because the Treaty of 1868 forbids it. The Treaty of 1868 guarantees that the Sioux will own the Black Hills for as long as the waters flow. And I was there a month ago. They're still flowing. So President Grant is up against the wall. We got people pouring into the Black Hills. He tells the Army, stop these invaders. But it's like trying to put a finger in a dike. Can't do it. So finally throws his arms up and says, let's buy the Black Hills from these people. They're just wasting the land anyway because they're not farming it. Let's offer $6 million. That's a lot of money in 1875. But charismatic leaders, Sitting Bull, Crazy Horse, Ice, Two Moon, others, no, not for sale. You don't sell the land that your ancestors walked on and now their bones lie beneath. Not for sale. Well, how about if we lease them? We'll give them back when we're done. That's kind of like the British Petroleum deal down in the Gulf. All that oil leaking out, no thanks. In frustration, Grant hands the problem over to the War Department, the architects of a military campaign to sweep the Sioux back onto reservations in the Dakotas, get them out of the way one final time. It's going to be designed by two of Grant's Civil War comrades, William Tecumseh Sherman and Phil Sheridan. And if you folks remember your U.S. history, those two boys burned down nearly half the South in the war between the states. Are there any folks by chance from the South here? Anybody? I guarantee you this, there's no Sherman Elementary Schools in Atlanta. They know what total war is, and they're going to try to wage it again on the northern plains. They're going to issue an ultimatum to the Sioux. It goes like this. Get out of the Black Hills. Get out of the Powder River country. And get out of the Rosebud country. And go back to your respective reservations and stay there. And do so by January 31st, 1876. Because if you don't, you're all going to be considered hostile. And the Army will come and get you and punish you until you return. Runners are sent out to inform the villages of this edict, but it's a bitter winter, the winter of 75 and 76. Howling winds, drifting snow, 40 below zero, not uncommon on the northern plains. We got some of that this winter here. You cannot move a village. It's paralyzed. There's no grass for the ponies. But more commanding than the weather itself is the counsel from Sitting Bull, who says to the people, don't go back. Don't go back to that reservation. You're all fools to make yourself a slave over a piece of fat bacon and some coffee and sugar. Stay out here. Live like a real Indian while you still can. He knew the sun was going down, but they listened and they stayed out. And those who'd wintered on the agencies in the spring of 76 began to trickle off and reinforce Crazy Horse and Sitting Bull out here in the Powder River country. And by the summer of 76, they're pouring off the reservations. So much so that by the day of the fight, June 25th, 1876, there's a village along the Little Bighorn River that's nearly 2 miles long. There's 7,000 to 8,000 people in that camp. 1,500 to 2,000 of them are warriors. They're not going back. No more bad flour. No more rotten meat. No more broken promises. Down in that valley, in that village, there's a number of warriors. Gall, Crow King, Two Moon, Low Dog, and a legendary warrior, Crazy Horse. Crazy Horse is 36 years of age, but at the age of 13 or 14, he seeks a vision to find out who he's supposed to be, what he's supposed to do. The Great Spirit comes to him in a dream, the Everywhere Spirit, God if you want, and says, you are to be a protector of your people. Bullets nor arrows will never harm you, but don't boast, don't brag. Be humble and reserved. How in the hell do you do that? In a warrior culture that's all about bravado, it's all about heroics, it's driven, fueled by testosterone, just like the NFL today. But Crazy Horse listens to God. And so when he goes into a fight, he goes about it way differently. He doesn't wear his best clothing or paint himself lavishly. He simply puts one feather in his hair, ties a brown pebble behind his ear, paints a yellow lightning bolt on his face, white hailstone spots on his chest, paints his horse with hailstone spots, ties the horse's tail up, picks up a handful of gopher dust, throws it on the horse, grabs a Winchester rifle, and goes to war. Other warriors follow him time after time, not because he can command them, but because of what he does on the battlefield. Fearless, aggressive, relentless. The stage is set. June 25th, wee hours of the morning, at 4:30, the Crow Scouts, Arikaras, and Crows, up on top of a high point 13 miles away from the battlefield, when the sun begins to come up and shed light on the valley of the Little Bighorn. The Crows look down, naked eyes, and they see smoke rising from the teepees. It's a massive camp. Custer has followed this trail for 3 days. There's three military columns in the field. Custer's one of them. He comes out of Fort Abraham Lincoln, 400 miles away. Two other military columns, one out of the south, Fort Fetterman. General George Crook comes up out of Wyoming with 1,000 soldiers, 260 Crow and Shoshone auxiliaries. They want to fight the Sioux for free. They hate the Sioux. Out of the west, Bozeman, Montana Territory, Fort Ellis, 450 soldiers march down the Yellowstone, led by Colonel John Gibbon. Gibbon walks like this because, you see, he stopped a bullet in Gettysburg and stopped Pickett's charge. The Crow Scouts call him No Hip. And George Armstrong Custer, all 12 companies of the 7th Cavalry, Expedition Commander General Alfred Terry, they know Custer's going to be the bloodhound. Custer's orders are very different than what most of you believe. Most of you in this audience tonight have been influenced by movies and bad books, as I mentioned earlier. Most people in the audience are going to think this. Custer was arrogant, vain, overconfident, a glory hunter. He was supposed to wait for other soldiers. He disobeyed his orders and rode to his death. Not quite. Let's take a look at who George Armstrong Custer is. George Armstrong Custer comes out of the Civil War. The boy general, Brigadier 23, Major General 26. He goes into battle time after time with a saber drawn. He's had 11 horses shot right out from underneath him. Saber charges. He doesn't lead men into battle from on top of a hill with binoculars sending men to their deaths. He's out in front. At Gettysburg, Custer's got 2,500 Michigan cavalry soldiers, volunteers. He goes up against Jeb Stuart east of Gettysburg. Stuart's got 5,000 Confederates. Custer pulls his saber out and says, "Come on, you Michigan Wolverines!" He charges down onto Stuart. 25 miles an hour, sabers drawn, horses clash, flip upside down, and crush their riders. Custer has two horses shot out from underneath him that day and gets on a third one. At Appomattox, when Lee surrenders to Grant, surrender documents are signed, ceremonies concluded. When it's all over with, Phil Sheridan picks up the table that the documents are signed on. Later presents it to Elizabeth Custer with these words, "I don't know of anyone who has played a greater role in ending this tragic conflict than your gallant husband." That table's in the Smithsonian Institute today. Arrogant, vain, overconfident, aggressive, fearless, relentless. Didn't I just talk about someone like that? Didn't I? Crazy Horse and Custer, both 36 years of age. Two warriors trapped in their own cultures, prisoners of their own times in a fight. Custer's supposed to wait for other soldiers? Here's his orders, given to him in writing by General Alfred Terry. They go like this. Lieutenant Colonel Custer, sir, I place too much confidence in your energy, zeal, and experience to hamper you with specific instructions when in close proximity to the warrior force. Use your own judgment and hang on to your wounded. Jerry was a lawyer. Pretty clever words. The other problem with this is Custer and three other military columns are hundreds of miles apart. What do they don't have? A cell phone. They can't talk to one another. They're hundreds of miles apart. And if you cannot communicate, you cannot. Who got it over here? Coordinate. Who said it? Who was it? You got an A. You can't communicate. You can't coordinate. You're on your own. George Armstrong Custer finds this massive camp. If he doesn't attack it, it's going to run away. And he's going to get court-martialed. So he attacks that camp, thinking that it is going to run, and it's not. As he approaches the village, he begins to divide his command. He sends Captain Frederick Benteen off to the south to scout with 125 men, three companies. Benteen hates Custer's guts, has no use for him. Benteen questions the order. General, perhaps we should keep the regiment together. If this village is as big as they say it is, we're going to need every man we've got. You have your orders, Benteen. Follow them. You're dismissed. Benteen hates Custer. Custer hates Benteen. And Reno hates both of them. Reno and Custer come off the divide, 12 miles out, 7 miles out, 3 miles from the Little Bighorn River. The scout Girard sees 60 warriors racing to the village. He screams out, "There go your Indians, General." And by God, they're running like devils. Custer sends immediate orders to Major Marcus Reno, second in command. "Major Reno, the village is just ahead. Move forward at as rapid a gait as you deem prudent. Sweep everything before you. Pitch into anything, and you'll be supported by the whole outfit." Reno crosses the river, cinches up his equipment, tightens his saddle girths, and charges down the valley towards the massive camp 3 miles beyond. Reno has 140 men. Inside of the village, it's chaos. They didn't expect to fight. They're caught off guard. I have people now at the battlefield say, "Oh no, Ranger Adelson, you can't sneak up on Indians." The hell you can. They got snuck up on. They weren't paying attention. They got caught off guard. When the village criers see the soldiers rumbling up the valley, they scream out, "Ota! Ota! The charges are coming!" Ota, Sioux soldier. "The charges are coming! The long knives, the blue coats!" Old women are hobbling on sticks trying to get away. Young mothers are frantically racing around trying to find their children who are swimming and playing. Inside the camp, Sitting Bull. He's 45. He's too old to fight, but not to lead. He exhorts the warriors on. "Brave up! Brave up! Strong hearts to the front! Cowards to the rear! Hokahay! It's a good day to die!" 15-16-year-old boys mount their horses and race out of the village. They tie sagebrush to the backs of their ponies' tails and ride back and forth, creating a giant dust cloud. As Reno thunders down the valley, faster and faster and faster, at 500 yards out, he knows two things. Number one, the village is not running away. And number two, he's never fought the Sioux and the Cheyenne before. At 300 yards, he will scream out, "Halt! Dismount! Form skirmish lines! Now, fight on foot!" 140 men attempt to rein their horses in at 25 miles an hour. Private Smith and Turley, two city boys, they can't ride so well. Fact is, they can't stop. They go right into the village. Their heads found on top of poles. 138 men dig in. Every fourth man's a horse holder. He takes his horse and three others, pulls them off the battle line, back into the timber along the river, protect horses and ammunition from the advancing warriors. Now that cuts the skirmish line down to 90 soldiers spread across the valley in 5-yard intervals, and in 10 minutes, they'll face 600 warriors. The company commanders, they order volley fire. They take their big bore Springfield carbine, 45-55 trapdoor single shot. It shoots a big chunk of lead. And if it hits you, something is going to fall off. They open up the breech, drop the cartridge into the breech, close the breech, cock the weapon, ready, aim, fire. Boom! 90 guns go off. Open the breech, eject the spent round, throw a new round in, close the breech, cock the weapon, ready, aim, fire. Boom! Another 90 guns go off. Big bullets rumbling into the village, crashing into the teepee poles and dropping them onto the ground. Inside the village, a warrior named Gaul. He's 6 feet tall, and he weighs 250 pounds. His two wives and three daughters are killed by Reno's attack. When he found out, he said, "It made my heart bad, and I fought back with a hatchet." Gaul, Crow King, Two Moon, Low Dog, Crazy Horse. They roar out of the village like angry bees out of a hive and slam into Reno. After 20 minutes, Reno collapses in retreat, falls back into the timber along the river, digs in for a second stand, but now the warriors get in behind him and they light the brush on fire. They snap buffalo robes, run his horses off, and his ammunition supply begins to get depleted. He's starting to feel very, very uncomfortable. He finally screams at the scout Bloody Knife, Custer's favorite, an Arikara. "Bloody Knife, what are the Indians doing?" Boom! Bloody Knife takes a bullet right in the head. His hot brains and blood go all over Reno's face. Right then, Major Marcus Reno begins to bark out commands that make no sense. "Mount! Dismount! Mount! Dismount!" Guys are going up and down. And then he screams out, "Those who want to make their escape and live, follow me." He crashes out of the timber, races back towards a river crossing 2 miles beyond. Other soldiers are trying to catch up. It's a rout. There's no attempt to cover the retreat at all. Warriors race up next to the fleeing soldiers and pump Winchester and Henry repeating rifles into the command. Boom, 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 boom! Two Moons, a Cheyenne chief. "We mowed the soldiers down. It was like a buffalo hunt. We came up behind the soldiers. We slipped our bowstrings over the soldiers' heads, jerked them off their horses, pounded them with clubs, and took their guns. And we counted coup, which means to touch an enemy with a stick and then bash his brains in. You're not brave. Why are you here? You did not bring enough soldiers. You better go back and get more. 40 men will die in this race with death through a gauntlet of hell." They get to the river crossing. Horses plunge off the bank, crash into the stream, flounder, and men drowned. Warriors on top of the ridges rain bullets into the crossing. Ladies and gentlemen, the river was red with blood. This was war. It wasn't cowboys and Indians, and it wasn't John Wayne. It was war. Reno scratches and claws and clambers across the river, climbs out onto the bank, gets on top of the high ground 5 miles from Last Stand Hill. Reno is a fractured commander, and his battalion is whipped and demoralized. About 10 minutes later, Captain Benteen returns from his scout to the south, approaches Reno on the high ground and snarls, "Where's Custer?" Reno says, "I don't know where Custer is, but for God's sake, Benteen, halt your command and help me. I've lost half my men." Well, Benteen's got a message in his pocket. It's from Custer, delivered to Benteen on the back trail by Giovanni Martini, the Italian orderly who can't speak English very well. Benteen hands a note to Reno. It reads, "Benteen, come on, big village. Be quick. Bring packs. P.S. Bring packs. Ammunition packs." Neither one of those officers is going to respond with any sense of urgency to that order. And it will haunt them for the rest of their days. In the meantime, Custer has advanced to the north with 5 companies, 210 men. He drops down into the valley at a place called Medicine Tail Coulee. He tries to cross the river and smash the Cheyenne camp. But Cheyenne warriors rain lead across the stream and quicksand halts the advance. Custer has to retreat and fall back up the ridge where all 5 companies gather at a place called Calhoun Hill today, named after James Calhoun, Custer's brother-in-law. James Calhoun is ordered to form a skirmish line. He takes 1 company. Company L, 40 men, forms a skirmish line facing the south. And for 45 minutes, he flails away, trying to hold warriors back. But then Gall, Crow King, Two Moon, Low Dog, Rain in the Face, after pounding Reno into hopeless submission, they peel off of Reno, roar down, and slam into Calhoun Hill like a red tidal wave. Company C, 40 men, mount their horses. They charge down the ridge, trying to drive warriors back down towards the valley. 2/3 of the way, they get off and they form a skirmish line and begin to fire their big bore carbines into the fleeing warriors. Temporarily, there's a lull in the fighting. But then, a southern Cheyenne chief named Lame White Man gets off his horse in the middle of the chaos, turns to the fleeing warriors and says, "Come back! Come back! There's not that many soldiers. We can kill them all." They rally up behind Lame White Man, storm back up the ridge, and crash into C Company. They snap buffalo robes, run their horses off, and their ammunition supply goes with it. C Company is in desperate straits. And then it gets worse. Because the legendary warrior Crazy Horse, after mauling Reno, disengages, flies down the west side of the Little Bighorn River, crosses right below Last Stand Hill, where Custer will die in 15 minutes. He roars up Deep Ravine, turns to the south, gets in behind C Company, and begins to assassinate the horse holders. Boom, 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 boom! Horse holders dead. Horses gone. Ammunition gone. C Company devastated. Those few boys left alive in C Troop are now unhorsed, and they run to the top of Battle Ridge. Lame White Man killed in the attack, shot dead by a Sioux warrior who mistakes him for a Crow scout and scalps him. Crazy Horse pivots on his pony, comes right at Last Stand Hill. 250 yards away, he bolts up over the top of Battle Ridge, down the other side, and runs right into the teeth of Company I, Miles Keogh. 45 dismounted skirmishers blast away at Crazy Horse as he rips by them on a bravery run. Bam! They don't hit him. And they're not going to hit him. And he knows it because of his vision. His magic is high. His medicine is strong. He looks over at White Bull. White Bull rips by them too. Bam! They don't hit White Bull either. Inspired by the courage of Crazy Horse and White Bull, warriors pour over Battle Ridge, charge down onto Keogh, slash into I Company, and grind Keogh into Gall, who's overrun Calhoun Hill from the south. Company I disappears. The only remnants of the fight today, 45 white tombstones on the other side of Battle Ridge, they look like ghosts in a lunch line. One survivor, a horse named Comanche, Miles Keogh's horse, shot to hell, found 3 days later stumbling along the riverbank. The horse is damn near dead, but somehow it hangs on. It follows the battered and beaten command back to the Bighorn River 15 miles away. They put it on a boat. 754 miles later, it stumbles down the gangplank at Fort Abraham Lincoln, and it will live another 15 years. It's never ridden again. The only time a saddle touches that horse's back is in a funeral procession with boots pointed backwards in the stirrups. And folks, the story goes, that's all that horse ever had to do to get an apple pie and all the beer he wanted to drink. He's now taking a long nap in a glass case in Lawrence, Kansas. Calhoun is dead. Keogh crushed. Lieutenant Colonel Custer swings around to the north, drops down off the ridge. He's going to try to get down to the river, cross the Little Bighorn River to the north, and capture all the fleeing, screaming women and children and helpless others who have run away from Reno's attack. If he can grab them as hostages, the battle's over. He did it at Ouachita in Oklahoma Territory in 68. Divided his command, pounced on a Cheyenne village. The fight was over in 20 minutes. He's going to do the same thing again. But it's not going to work this time because Sitting Bull has other plans. He has those helpless people in his grasp, and he's not going to let go. At the river crossing, Sioux and Cheyenne sentries slam the door, lock it, and throw the key away for eternity. Custer has to retreat, fall back up on top of Last Stand Hill where he drives warriors off the hill and then digs in. Just about the same time that Keogh caves in. Now, ladies and gentlemen, the full fury of 1,500 to 2,000 warriors will bear down on George Armstrong Custer and 42, about 70 men. The sky is raining arrows, gunfire, smoke, yelling, screaming, cursing, more ammo, more ammo, eagle bone whistles shrieking across the battlefield in the dust and the smoke. Bugle calls, Two Moon, a Cheyenne chief. We swirled around the soldiers like water around a stone. 20-year-old Cheyenne warrior Wooden Leg. It looked like 1,000 dogs in a fight. Gall, the soldiers were fighting good. They were loading and firing and loading and firing. But then, 35 or 40 of them, six or seven mounted, the rest running. They bolted off the hill, charged down towards the river. We caught them in the ravine, and we killed them all. 28 dead men found after the battle by Reno Benteen survivors, buried in a crack in the earth. E Company, the Gray Horse Troop, now 142 years later, with the best archaeological equipment in the world, we cannot find a shred of their existence. Not a button, not a bone, not a bullet, not a thing. Now we call them the Mystery Company. Back up on the hill, Low Dog, the soldiers kept firing and firing and firing and firing, but then they threw their big guns onto the ground. And they took out their little guns. And they tried to kill us. But they shot wildly in the sky as their horses bucked and shied and pulled them all around. A desperate order. Shoot your horse. Boom! A bullet in your horse's head. 39 dead horses found in a heap on top of Last Stand Hill after the fight. You're not going home now. There's nowhere to run to, and there's nowhere to hide, except behind a dead horse. Warriors get closer and closer. They ask Gall, 10 years after the battle, how long did the fight last? He said about as long as it takes for a hungry man to eat his dinner, and then the shots. Boom, 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 boom! Boom! Quit coming. Warriors watching in the draws in the ravines mount their horses, blast up the hill, ride right into the crowd of paralyzed survivors, and pound them to death. Then they roar down to meet Reno and Benteen, who'd made a feeble effort to advance to the sound of the gunfire, drove them back, pinned them down, trapped them under siege for the next 24 hours. Captain Benteen will step up for a shell-shocked Reno. It's a groundhog case now, boys. It's do or die. Dig rifle pits. They began to scratch and claw at the ground with cups and spoons and pocket knives in their hands. Those rifle pits are still at Little Bighorn. 24 hours later, the massive village begins to break up and scatter to the south as they detect the oncoming military column of Gibbon and Terry from the northwest. And by the time the sun goes down, June 26th, 1876, there's hardly a handful of warriors in sight. With courage, high ground, and 26,000 rounds of ammunition, Captain Benteen has saved 350 men on top of Reno Hill. 24 of them will get a Medal of Honor. George Armstrong Custer and all five companies, 210 men destroyed, 263 total. 60 warriors confirmed dead in this battle, maybe more in the battle of the Little Bighorn is over. After the battle, 6 months later, Sitting Bull goes to Canada with a band. He stays up there for 5 years. When he returns in 1881, he's arrested, placed on a reservation, but he's allowed to tour with Buffalo Bill Cody in the Wild West show. He's often seen in New York, Chicago, Baltimore, handing money out on street corners to orphans. He can't figure it out. Why would anybody allow children to starve in a nation that has everything? On a cold December dawn in 1890, 2 weeks prior to the Wounded Knee Massacre, Sitting Bull is arrested on the reservation by Indian policemen. He's drug out of his cabin. An argument breaks out and then a gunfight. He's shot in the back of the head and killed. His body thrown into a pit with a sack of lime. A year after the battle, Crazy Horse surrenders at Fort Robinson, Nebraska. His people have been hunted, hounded, and harassed. The women are freezing. The children are starving. And they are out of hope. Crazy Horse, shot in the back of the, stabbed in the back for resisting arrest. He drops dead 6 hours later. This battle shattered lives. Major Marcus Reno, second in command at Little Bighorn, inherits all the blame, or most of it, after the last gunshot is fired. He's accused of cowardice, dereliction of duty, drunkenness, on and on. He crawls deeper inside of a bottle to try to drown his demons, but they only multiply. He asks for a court of inquiry to clear his name. In 1879, he's found not culpable, but the criticism rages on. He's kicked out of the service for drinking. He dies in a Washington, D.C. hospital all alone of tongue cancer, buried in a pauper's grave in Washington, D.C. 77 years later, his family petitions Congress and the Army to overturn his court-martial conviction. It's overturned. He's disinterred, brought out to Little Bighorn Battlefield National Monument, Custer National Cemetery, buried in 1967 with full military honors. He sleeps today beneath the flagpole below the vaunted On Last Stand Hill. Captain Benteen will also succumb to the scourge of Little Bighorn. He dies a bitter and twisted, broken-down alcoholic, forced to resign his military commission. He dies of a stroke at the age of 64, buried in Arlington National Cemetery. Ladies and gentlemen, this was war. Elizabeth Bacon Custer outlives them all. She writes 3 best-selling books, glorifying and deifying her husband and attacking Captain Benteen and Major Reno for the rest of her life. She speaks all over the world. She has $140,000 in the bank when she dies. She's beautiful and highly educated and an extraordinary writer. She convinces a lot of people about a lot of things. She gives that $140,000 to women's colleges for scholarships. Some of you purchased my book tonight. It's called Little Bighorn Voices from a Distant Wind. I've got a poem and a story about Elizabeth Custer in that book. The poem is called Elizabeth Custer, The Enduring Life Dedicated to a Legend. I'm going to share a few lines with you and then we'll close. Her night death had taken, now alone to keep the flame, burning hot through all the years, the famous Custer name. Quite a beauty Libby was, dark hair and ample curve. Custer a meteor, soaring fast, blessed with too much nerve. Now final rest did come to pass, both each other found. Now Libby sleeps once more at Old West Point with her knight beneath the ground. Maybe. Thank you very much.